I can't bring you flowers.
You can't sing me love songs.
I don't try to talk anymore, since each word has to be
non-sexist, non-racist, non-heterosexist, post-feminist, multiculturalist, secular humanist, environmentalist, and 100% free of the slightest trace of Eurocentricity.
I remember when I treat you like my honey.
You treat me like the victim of institutionalized patterns of discrimination against women, gays, indigenous peoples, Aleutian Islanders, spotted owls, and laboratory bunnies.
I don't sort all my trash into 12 garbage pails. I don't spend every weekend out saving the whales. And I read lots of books by those old
dead white males.
Shakespeare will be
barred
forevermore.
You're reactionary. Just check the dictionary.
A waiter or waitress is now
a waitron.
That means Trinidad now must be called
Trinitron.
My pretty white pet kitty is now my
monochromatic oppressed fellow mammal. And please don't engage in species chauvinism by calling your aesthetically advantaged feline companion pretty.
When you play referee, babe, our love's growing cold. No, I'm not quite PC, babe, or so I've been told. Is your problem with me that I'm getting too old?
I'd never call you old. I'd call you chronologically challenged.
We male chauvinist pigs once could always get kissed. Now our species is on the endangerment list. If we can't find a mate, we'll die out and be missed.
Missed.
Extinct, just like the giant dinosaur.
Extinct! This male chauvinist pig I must love and protect. For to love endangered species is
politically correct.
You can bring me
floriculturally diverse, polyfragrant, soilistically challenged, multi-petaled victims of pesticidal food chain chauvinism.
A pistol and a stamen. stay person. You can bring me flowers.
Evermore.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning in, we're listening to The Myth of the Good Wars with Howard Zinn.
A year before, and here's just a little historical bit of evidence to just throw into the hopper. A year before Lexington and Concord, in other words, a year before the fighting began against England, farmers in western Massachusetts, all over the western Massachusetts, had driven out the British officials from the seats of government, the judges and the local officials, and had taken over much of western Massachusetts. And remember, at that time, you know, Boston, the city, was a very small percentage of the Massachusetts population. 90% of the people of Massachusetts lived out in the country. And in those places in the country, the British were driven out without a war. They were driven out by huge numbers of people that gathered and made it impossible for them to continue. I mean, there's a book been written about that, a book which hadn't gotten a lot of attention, because very often books that tell the truth do not get a lot of attention. They tell you things you don't want to hear. A book by a man named Ray Raphael, he wrote a book actually called The People's History of the American Revolution. People's History of the American Revolution, I recommend it, naturally. But he also wrote another book called The First American Revolution, and it's about those events that take place before Lexington and Concord, in which people nonviolently, that is without a war, take over. And so you wonder, at least makes you wonder, could have been possible without a war for the colonists to resist England, to build up an underground, to wage a kind of guerrilla warfare, to make it impossible for the British to govern without a war. And after all, when a place becomes impossible to govern, even imperial powers retreat from them. They can't control the situation, and so they leave. It's worth thinking about. Okay. So much for that holy war. The Civil War. Well, on the plus side, right, the balance sheet, slavery. I mean, you can't deny that. The Civil War is fought and slavery is ended. But even while not forgetting that, I mean, that is very, very important. While not forgetting that, it's worthwhile at least looking at the other side of the balance sheet. 600,000 dead in the Civil War. I mean, how many people knew those figures? Most people haven't even thought about it. They know it's a bloody war, okay, but people haven't thought 600,000. In a population of 30 million, 600,000 today would mean we fought a civil war in which 5 million people died. What if we wanted to end racial segregation? Well, or maybe even slavery. Should we fight a war in which 5 million people die in order to end slavery? Now, of course, we want slavery to end, but is this the only way it could have been done with a war that takes 600,000 lives? There are countries in other parts of the world and in the Western Hemisphere that did away with slavery and without a bloody war. All over Latin America and the West Indies. It's worth thinking about. It's not that we want to retain slavery. No, we do want to end slavery. But again, have to let our imaginations go. Is it possible slavery might have been ended some other way? Maybe it would have taken longer. This is a very important factor. If you want to avoid horrendous violence and accomplish something, you may have to wait longer. The nice thing about violence, it's fast. You want to accomplish something fast, violence will do it. But very often you can accomplish the same thing without violence if you have a more orchestrated plan of not submission, not appeasement, not giving in, not allowing the status quo to go on, but gradually eroding the status quo. Think of South Africa. The African National Congress, which was, you know, represented the black population of South Africa, the African National Congress could have, they're facing apartheid, which is a kind of slavery, certainly, not far from slavery, apartheid. They could have fought the majority of the population in South Africa. They could have fought a bloody, they could have gotten arms from the outside. They had friends and sympathizers. They could have instigated an armed rebellion to overthrow the apartheid regime. And they would have won, probably won. How long would it take? Maybe a couple of years, who knows? 2, 3, 4, we don't know exactly. How many people would die in the course of that struggle? Oh, we don't know, 1 million, 2 million, most of them black, right? But at the end of it, apartheid would be over. And people would say, that's the only way it could have been done. Just as they say about the Revolutionary War, that's the only way we could have won independence. About a civil war, that's the only way could have ended slavery. By the way, just a footnote about ending slavery after the Civil War. We did not really end slavery. It's not simply, oh, they were slaves and now they're free. No, they weren't free. They were put back into serfdom, not slavery, but serfdom after the Civil War. They were left without resources. And they had to go back and work now for the same plantation owners that they were enslaved by, now that, but with the same kinds of restrictions on them because they had no resources. So to say slavery was ended, not quite true. And as you know, black people then went through 100 years after the supposed end of slavery and after the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments were passed to the Constitution promising racial equality, so on. For 100 years after the supposed end of slavery, black people are segregated and live as second-class human beings. So while on a positive side you say, oh, we ended slavery, well, you have to put quotation marks around end of slavery. Not quite. So, yeah, these are things worth considering.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Was a decorated general with a heart of gold that likened him to all the stories he told of past battles won and lost and legends of old. A seasoned veteran in his own time, on the battlefield he gained respectful fame with many medals of bravery and stripes to his name. He grew a beard as soon as he could to cover the scars on his face and always urged his men on. But on the eve of a great battle with the infantry and dream, the old general tossed in his sleep and wrestled with its meaning. He awoke from that night to tell what he had seen and walked slowly out of his tent. All the men held tall with their chests in the air, with the courage in their blood and a fire in their stare. And it was a gray morning and they all wondered how they would fare. So the old general told them to go home. He said,
I have seen the others and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. And I've seen their mothers and I will no other to follow me where I'm going. So, take a shower and shine your shoes. You got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Take a shower and shine your shoes. You got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven.
But the men stood fast with their guns on their shoulders, not knowing what to do with the contradicting orders. The general said he would do his own duty, but he extended no further. The men could go as they pleased, but not a man moved. Their eyes gazed straight ahead till one by one they stepped back and not a word was said. And the old general was left with his own words echoing in his head. He then prepared to fight. He said,
I have seen the others and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. No. And I've seen their mothers, and I will no other to follow me where I'm going. So, take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living.
Yeah.
Take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven.
Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go. Yeah.
Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go. Oh. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you got to be, got to be, got to be, got to be.
And now, back to Howard Zinn and the myth of the good wars.
I'll go quickly to World War II, to the next holy war. Every one of these, of course, there's a lot more to be said about each one of these situations, but World War II is especially difficult because, for one thing, it's in our time. You know, if not us, it's our fathers and or grandfathers. You know, that is, we know people who were in World War II. And I was in World War II. I almost forgot. And I volunteered for the Air Force. I was an enthusiastic bombardier. I went over and I bombed cities in Europe. France, Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, France. The good war. Fascism. Why did I enlist? Fascism, right? What could be more obvious than the need to defeat fascism? What more ugly phenomenon is there in the world than fascism, Nazism, and all of that? So yes, that's why I enlisted. And that's why, once I enlisted, I didn't question anything. Because this is the way things are. And it's an interesting psychological trick that's played upon us, or that we play upon ourselves. And that is, once you make a decision that you are the good guys and they are the bad guys, in other words, once you've settled the moral issue about right and wrong, it's settled. You don't have to think about it anymore. From that point on, anything you do is okay. You don't question it. You're the good guys, they're the bad guys. Now you could kill them all. You could kill people who have nothing to do with the bad guys. You could kill 600,000 civilians in Germany. Who are these civilians? They're not all Nazis. They're like Americans during the Vietnam War, right? Kill another 600,000 civilians in Japan. But we don't question that. It's a good war. It's the right thing. They're the bad. We're good. Very important to stop at every inch along the way of a historical event and ask questions again and again. What are you doing and why are you doing this? Because otherwise you will be, as General Grove said about Harry Truman and the dropping of the bomb, you'd be like a little boy on a toboggan going down the hill, can't stop. But after the war, I began to think about the war. Not that I had different thoughts about fascism. No, fascism is still evil, and it's good to get rid of fascism. But 50 million people died in World War II. That has to be put on one side of the balance sheet. Okay, on the other side of the balance sheet, Hitler is gone. Mussolini is gone. Japanese military junta is gone. But is fascism gone? Have we, you know, when I was discharged from the Air Force, I got this letter from General Marshall. He was a general over all the generals, and a letter of congratulation, personal letter, of course, to me, to me and 16 million others. You know, congratulations, you know, you have played a part, and we have won this war, and it will be a new world. Well, no, it wasn't a new world. Hasn't been a new world. I mean, it's, you know, like asking questions. Did we really free the slaves? And 50 million people are dead. Isn't it at least worth asking the question, could fascism, and granted, we don't want to submit to fascism. We don't want countries to take over other countries and et cetera, et cetera. We don't want any of that. We'd like to do something about fascism. But is it possible that we did something about it in the crudest possible way? That is, with war, which is the crudest way you can deal with any problem, the most unfocused, bluntest, undifferentiated act of violence, a series of acts of violence. Is it possible that we could have found other ways to deal with Hitler and fascism? Not appeasement, you know, oh, wow, you mustn't have appeasement. Of course not. But in between total war and appeasement, couldn't there be 100 other possibilities of resistance, of guerrilla warfare, of sabotage, of something that would take longer, granted. War, you can get rid of Hitler in 5 years. How long did it take? Yeah, something like that. But what if you had a different plan and a different scenario? Is it possible that you could have defeated fascism by a more sophisticated set of responses of resistance, which would not involve the crudity of war in which both sides become monsters? Because that's what happens in war. In war, they're the monsters, and then you become monsters. In war, both sides become monsters. The Japanese commit atrocities, we commit atrocities. The Germans bomb civilian populations, we bomb civilian populations. That's what war does. War poisons everybody who engages in it. And at the end of it, you've won something, but then when you look carefully at it, what have you won? And how long does it last? And shouldn't you consider, even though it's very hard to use your imagination and to consider that there might have been other scenarios, shouldn't you at least begin to think about it? Because if you don't begin to think about it, you'll be stuck in this very common cultural acceptance of war as the way to solve things. And then the next president who comes along and says, and he could be a Democrat as well as a Republican, because Democrats have as good a record of going to war as Republicans. The next president comes along and says, something has happened here in this part of the world, and or an explosion has taken place in Philadelphia, or something has happened and we've got to go to war. Don't even think about it. Yeah, that's the way to go. But 9/11 has taken place, invade Afghanistan, bomb Afghanistan. Anybody stop and think, what is that going to do? How will that change things? Will that do away with terrorism in the world? So I'm suggesting that we have to at least begin to question these so-called wars, because we want, I think, to reach a situation in the world where war is not acceptable, no matter what the reason is given. Yeah. 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 Not acceptable. War in our time is always a war against innocent people, especially children. But no matter what the objective, however noble the objective, get rid of this tyrant or stop this aggression, whatever the good reason is on the good side of the ledger, on the bad side of the ledger will be huge numbers of innocent people will die, and a large number of them children. And the world will be poisoned once again with the germ of war, and we'll continue our addiction to war. That's another thing to think about. War is addictive, and the more shots you take of it, the more addicted you become. And we have to break our habit. Thank you. How many Americans saw Pearl Harbor was bombed, we were attacked? Assuming that Pearl Harbor is us, that's assuming that Pearl Harbor is our country. Pearl Harbor was our colony. Our colony, one of our colonies was attacked, a colony in which we had amassed a huge military force.
Blink of an eye. night, so we hope you make it home alive. Another two dead, said the news report. Two young people's lives cut short. I've got the paper open with a stomach like lead, looking for your name in the list of the dead. But it's somebody's daughter or it's somebody's son, and it doesn't make a difference which country they're from. Soldier or insurgent, it hits home the same. Another family torn apart by the profit game. They've got bombs on the road, you've got bombs in the sky. So many dying for a flag to fly. Everything can change in the blink of an eye, so we hope you make it home alive.
Now for something completely different.